Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right. Just waiting for the music.
Cool.
That's what we do.
Yep.
Waiting for, oh, there's the music. We can start
totally
now.
Pavlovian.
Oh, uh-oh. Speaking of Pavlovian.
Hi, I'm Molly Wood.
Oh, my God. It's backwards. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
It's so confusing. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where the producers are keeping us on our toes with the rundown. It is our podcast where we talk about tech, the economy, and culture, and where none of us is as smart as all of us.
So here's what happened. Last month, a guy by the name of Neil Kashkari, you might remember him from the financial crisis. He worked for Henry Paulson at the Treasury Department. He is now the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, and he went out to a Native American economic conference to talk about all things Native American and economic advancement, really, which is the key point, which got us thinking about how innovation and technology and some of the stuff we talk about might hopefully somehow possibly improve Native American economies. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Yep. And it is fascinating because, of course, there are tons of businesses that operate only online today. In theory, many will argue, and by many I mean Amazon, that this means more opportunities for different parts of the country, specifically for Native American communities, for the purposes of today's conversation, which are often rural and remote, and that they're combined with a basket of other technologies that should hopefully bring economic development, 5G rolling out in urban areas and more rural areas over time. And then next year, there is a Wiring the Res conference, referring to reservations, because just getting signal in some places is still not a sure thing.
But even once you get signal, it's just not that simple, right? A whole lot of really complicated issues with Native Americans and their lands and sovereignty and interaction with the federal government and regulators and all of that stuff. And all of that plays into economic opportunity and financial technology innovation. So what we have done is gotten a guy by the name of Dante Desiderio on the phone to come on the program. He is the executive director of the Native American Financial Officers Association. Dante, thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let me ask you the first question, and it goes like this. This is going to sound stupid, but what do Native American financial officers do? Tell the brief sketch of the economies that you all are dealing with.
One of our bigger charges early on in the 1980s was to really get capital into Indian country and also come up with a common financial management system for tribal governments to be able to make getting capital easier. So over time, our role has changed in really trying to represent tribal governments in building out their economies. So we really jump into some of the what's become more traditional activities, like gaming and oil and gas, farming, government contracting, and also take on new opportunities in those sectors as well. Energy is a great example, and so is the adoption of the new hemp regulations the other day, which includes tribes and cannabis and some of these other interesting fields for tribal governments to jump into.
Give us a snapshot before we sort of talk about technology and economic development. Give us a snapshot, if you would, from your perspective of what the barriers are when it comes to getting capital or, like you said, you know, harmonizing the way that different tribal governments from different tribes work together.
Well, there's some structural barriers that go into our historic relationship with the federal government. And I think it might be helpful to really take a look back into how we got here. In the 1950s, the federal government had a policy of termination. So they were either sending individual Indians out to cities to live in or dismantling reservations. So needless to say, that wasn't a helpful policy for economic development for Indian country. But during the Nixon administration, that all changed. So we went to self-determination. It's one of the most significant federal contributions to growing the Indian country economy and for tribes in general. And that really started into this whole creative experiment of how tribal governments are evolving at this point. It took a while to get started, and it took a while to get capital into Indian country because of the structural barriers of looking into jurisdiction, sovereignty, and all of those different terms that banks were unfamiliar with.
Yeah, for sure. So it's not really an income problem, right? Because there is gaming, there is some energy, as you spoke about. It's, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, it's outside investors being willing to put in that capital.
That's right. It's just outside investors being willing to learn about Indian country. And I think once they do, they see it as a viable market. Our conferences and our relationships with the capital markets has grown recently, and it's mostly from the firms who are taking the time to learn that difference and put in the work, and it can be very rewarding. It is a mixed bag, to say the least. Yeah. But tribes are in all different forms of or stages of economic development, and I think at this point in our development, it's really an exciting time to take a look at tribes and some of the innovative things they're doing. And it's also an interesting time to try to figure out what can make things work for those tribes that are not advancing as much as others.
What do they have to learn? Like, does each, how self is the self-determination? Like, does each tribe and each tribal government have different approaches or, you know, different rules? Like, to when you say they have to learn about working with tribal governments, what, how far does that go? What does that entail?
Well, there's some general rules about, you know, the sovereignty issue, or, and we do waive sovereignty or limited sovereignty for economic enterprises and things like that. But a lot of banks or investment firms are less willing to sort of go along that, you know, to learn about that. Some of the other issues here for economic development, you have to look at where tribes are located. So they're naturally going to build out enterprises that fit in with their either their land holdings or fit in with their place in metropolitan centers. So, for example, on the tribes that may have natural resources, like a tribe in North Dakota, they may be building out their oil and gas reserves and being a significant contributor in that. And we even have a tribe in Colorado that has gone out and not only developed their natural resources in a way that really takes ownership of the enterprises, but they're also building out that diversification beyond their reservation boundaries to as far as the Gulf of Mexico, where they own some platforms there. So it's different for every tribe. And looking at the tribes that are close to a metropolitan center, you naturally have the gaming markets and those destinations that are being built out in really creative ways that's a little bit different from the commercial industry and creating the more of a destination, and there's more ability to build that out when the government is owning those enterprises.
So this is a little bit of a tricky question to ask, but if you're a banker doing a risk analysis and you look at a lot of Native American tribes and lands and the businesses that are going, once you get past gaming and energy, my bet would be that a lot of people see a lot of downside risk because of the way that the tribes have been treated by the federal government and what that has brought, which is unemployment and social problems and all of that. Could you talk about that for a minute?
So once you get by the high margin businesses like energy and gaming, you do have tribes that have been you know, participating in some of these other industries and really trying to diversify or build out some of these things that are going to impact their economies. And it is a little bit more difficult. But one of the things, and the reason we invite the capital markets in to take a closer look, is that the underwriting is different. You're not dealing with just a single business. You're dealing with underwriting the government itself and really leveraging the revenue of the government to make those loans work. And
sorry,
I think that's one of the
government,
significant differences.
Sorry to interrupt. The government being the tribal government that runs the lands and the enterprise, right?
Yeah, and you're hitting on a really important difference. This is something that's come out of this self-determination. Is our economic model is different for a very specific reason. So we have, coming out of the self-determination, the federal government really isn't, you know, there's not a lot of hope that they're going to meet their treaty obligations and really fully fund those obligations. So tribes, being on federal trust lands, don't have the ability, like other governments, to really implement a property tax or some other taxes like every other government has to make those things run. So what we've done is become more versatile and more versed in economic development as filling that gap. So that's why the economic development component is so important to tribes. Yeah. And for a lot of reasons, you know, we're at risk sometimes if we do have a recession because we rely on those revenues for programs and services. But it's really the government role that's a lot different than looking at other other government models or even other commercial models. I think we've adapted, like we usually do over time, into having this different model work. And I think that's really getting to the crux of this underwriting. It's underwriting the government in a lot of places and getting back to the idea of, you know, financial services being implemented through technology. It's a great idea. But the banking, you know, especially considering we're going to be potentially leapfrogging over the branch networks things like that, that's great. But it's like most things where there's some places where it's going to work really well and other places where there is challenges of even the connectivity at all. So we're looking at, you know, some of those structural challenges for making things work for any sort of access or moving on to some of these other technologies that hold a lot of promise.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of those technologies and the potential promise. There is this big tribal conference coming up, Wiring the Res 2020, which I gather will be focused on things like 5G and e-commerce and ensuring equal access to internet in various locations. What do you know about this event and what are some of those goals?
Well, the event is really good to really compare where things are. And I think for tribes, looking at where their role in this, we have a lot of creativity on, like you're saying, e-commerce, where tribes are actually getting into that space on their own. We also have them using that sort of connectivity to distribute government services on debit-like instruments for maybe an elders program or something like that. So they're being creative in that space. And on the other side of it, those tribes that might be wired are looking at building out data centers that are some in partnership with the Department of Defense for highly secure centers. And, you know, some other tribes are looking at starting their or have started their own telecommunications firms to be able to build out that last mile. And I'm not sure if 5G is going to be the answer on for a lot of these things, but it can help for those tribes that are already wired. So you can see tribes are reacting to, one, the importance of telecommunications, which is why the conference is being hosted, but also being creative and trying to build into that space and make that work for an economic enterprise.
So what do you think? I mean, what's the prognosis, I guess? And yes, I know it's been 300 years of history, but...
So the last 45 years under self-determination has been this great experiment playing out with tribal governments. And when you look at where tribes are today and all the coordinating and sharing stories and looking at what's worked and what hasn't worked, I don't think there's a more exciting time to really be in this space. There is a lot that is going on in tribes and a lot of industries that are coming up. Tribes are even looking, when you look at governments, we largely go invisible. And I think some of these experiments that are playing out really have implications for the mainstream. It's really interesting that the CEOs of the major companies are coming out with this idea that shareholders aren't the most important thing. And the way that tribes have been doing this for all along is that you look at the impact of the community first, or the community that you're in, make sure you're building out your culture, or your identity within those enterprises, and also looking at these impacts that go beyond just the bottom line. And I think that's great that mainstream America is adopting it. I think that's the way things will continue to move. And all of these things that are playing out now, and including some of the industries that we've been in for a while, I think it'll continue to adapt. And, you know, there's so many exciting things going on within the traditional industries, but also looking at the wealth of some of these tribes and looking at how they're investing for the next several generations and looking at that asset management and diversification. You know, I think we've learned our lessons over the last 45 years under self-determination and are looking really to help get to this next state of building out our economies.
Dante Desiderio, he's the executive director of the Native American Financial Officers Association, talking about really sort of an undercover topic. I appreciate your time, Dante. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you both. I appreciate it.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, it's really interesting.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, this is where I grew up, right? When he talks about the tribes in North Dakota. I mean, I'm always like, I know that. I know.
Yeah.
What are we going to? And it really like, it's such a microcosm of so many American issues. Yeah. Like some tribes have a lot of money. Yep. Some tribes have a lot of access to resources and some don't. And, yeah. you know, and it's really, I think you hate to project that technology can solve every problem. But if there can be economic development, and not every tribe wants to be invested
yep.
in gaming
yep, for
or
sure.
in extraction of natural resources on their own land. And so to the extent that there can be opportunity to build out economies that are more yep. diversified overall, it's just, it's super interesting. And yes, something that we, frankly, are like shamefully ignorant of
yeah.
in America.
Yeah.
So.
For those who are Native Americans and who listen to this podcast, let us know what you think. Mm-hmm. Honestly, did we ask the right questions? What else do we need to do? And what's your experience out there with economic challenges or the upsides too? Maybe something better.
Yeah.
Send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Back in a minute.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right, we're back. We're back. We're back. We're back. Time for, you know, that thing that is on our minds that Molly Wood never has ready, but, you know.
I totally don't.
You want to just pass? All right.
Yeah,
well, you know what?
Help me.
Okay.
We'll just do yours because I think it's the same one.
It is actually a really good one, and it goes to something we have talked about on this podcast quite a bit about Facebook and, for my money anyway, the glaring ignorance of so many consumers in this economy of Facebook products, specifically WhatsApp and Instagram, not knowing that they are using Facebook. Because people say, oh, yeah, I'm off Facebook. And I say, oh, yeah, how was your Instagram feed? And they go, oh, yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it. So, look, Facebook owns them all. But now it's rebranding them. And it's going to be, not conspicuously, but it will be more present. Facebook branding will be more present on Instagram's page and on the WhatsApp app, which I think is really interesting. It's probably more savvy as Facebook gets more scrutiny. I just think it's fascinating. And that's my thing.
It's funny. You wonder if it's savvy.
Or?
Because it could go either way. I agree with you. I think this is totally fascinating and also have been following the fact that Facebook has now rebranded itself to Facebook. Like they just put their name in all caps now. Like it's just Facebook shouting at you. I don't really understand what that's about. And also, I would just like to point out that having spent roughly a decade in what I like to call the Yahoo Wars, which is working at publications who refused to put the exclamation point in Yahoo in print, The effort by Facebook to have all of us write Facebook in all caps in our stories is just like not going to work.
Mollywood doing her own sound effects. We don't need audio engineers on this podcast. Molly does them all.
What you do is when you want to shout, you turn your head to the right and then you don't blow out anybody's
ears.
There's a
little echo in there. Come on. That was awesome.
Like, yeah. But so with respect to their corporate branding overall, on the one hand, you could argue that it is not a smart idea to like let everybody who's mad at Facebook know that you own Instagram.
Yeah, totally.
Because they've really been skating. On the other hand, it could be arguably very savvy to get everybody who loves Instagram realizing that Facebook owns them, so that every time that somebody says they should break up Facebook and split off Instagram, that someone goes, wait, are you going to try to kill my Instagram? Because I'm not having it. Yeah. And so it's a bet. It's a very interesting bet by Facebook that the love for Instagram will outweigh the disdain for Facebook, the brand. And I, for one, am actually really interested to see who's right? Like, how this bet's going to fall.
It's really
like a coin flip.
Yeah, totally. I have not been on Facebook in a year and a half, and I thought the other day about deleting my Facebook account, and I probably will. But I scroll through Instagram twice a day. Truly, I do.
Yeah.
You know? So, guilty.
I know. All right. It's a tough one.
All right, moving on.
I'm with you on this.
Moving on.
And that's all we got.
There we go.
Because I just biffed
it. We would keep going. Yeah. Facebook!
All right. Okay. Go.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Yes. So, Facebook. I didn't turn my head. I talked to a guy by the name of Graham Warwick last week about electric airplanes.
So awesome.
Which
by
I thought
the way,
was completely
so awesome.
Fascinating. And I asked, would you fly in one? Here's Steve Gammon.
Hey, Kai. This is Steven from Cincinnati.
Hey, Steve.
Would I fly in an electric plane? First, I've suspended all disbelief when I bought a ticket for a hunk of aluminum that someone told me would float up into the sky and not fall out of it. Second, a motor is a motor. As long as it spins the turbine or the propeller fast enough to keep the plane moving, I don't care if it's powered by electricity or jet fuel or magic.
Yes, I get that.
I love that
guy. No, it's a great answer. But isn't there something visceral about a jet engine and fire and thrust and we're going to go, right? Because that's what
says
jet
muscle.
Engines are. You know, I mean,
says
come on.
Muscle car, Kai.
Right. Well,
literally, Elon Musk is about to email you right now and be like,
shut
I'm
up.
Sorry,
my first car was a 19.
19-
we've had this conversation about my first muscle car. But anyway, I think there's something visceral about a jet engine as opposed to and a freaking battery driving a propeller. Come on, man.
Well, that's like a different question. What you're asking is, would you like it?
Well,
would it be as fun taking off? It was like, like a rocket ship. I mean, sure, maybe not the same. However, to our next piece of feedback, you would potentially feel less guilty. Kai also talked about flight shaming and this idea that you should feel bad about flying. Side note, because we also did that the episode the week before about fast fashion.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Being so bad for the environment. And did you see the H&M CEO basically come out and say that things like shaming people for fast fashion or for flying is going to have like massive social consequences and tear apart the fabric of society?
Of course.
Okay, H&M guy. Look, I had a news fix after all.
Oh, please. No ex post facto news fixes.
There are no rules. Flight shaming, of course, the idea that you should feel bad about flying because of how it impacts the environment, or that you should encourage your company to have like local meetings or use Zoom instead of flying people everywhere. And we do have at least one guilty Gary in the crowd.
Hey, Kai and or Molly. This is Josh from Rochester, New York. I just listened to last week's episode where Kai mentioned flight shaming. This winter, I will be taking a lot of flights, and I'm definitely feeling some internal flight shaming or flight guilt. I've been hearing lately about carbon offsetting, where you offset your carbon emissions by funding efforts like planting trees or purchasing solar panels for impoverished areas. I found two sites, goldstandard.org and carbonfund.org, that actually seem pretty legitimate. But how much does this actually help versus just making me feel better and not actually addressing the problem? Is carbon offsetting a feasible way to address the carbon issue in the medium or long term?
I believe it's making you feel better, but that's just one man's opinion.
They are mostly making you feel better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something. And so if you invest, if you are investing in a project that can reduce emissions or improve carbon storage, and frankly, that is in some cases just planting a tree, that is a good thing. It's funny because I just did a panel on a version of this topic, which is companies buying renewable energy so that, for example, Google says, you know, we're powered by 100% renewable energy. What that means is they invested in projects that added renewable energy to grids somewhere. It does not mean that their data centers are running on 100% renewable energy.
Exactly.
It is essentially sort of like a complicated form of offsetting. The goal for somebody like Google is like Google has enough money to say, well, we're actually going to sponsor a solar development project on the same grid that we operate on so that they're actually displacing some dirty energy and adding clean to the grid overall. Most offsetting basically is like a good thing happened over here, a bad thing happened over here. It is not necessarily a one-to-one replacement, but it will make you feel better in the sense that a good thing did happen over here. A tree got planted or some sequestration happened or some emissions were reduced.
Yep.
So if it'll make you feel better, do it.
Do it.
And then ideally do it and also not fly. Winning.
All right. We had a couple of people run in to tell us about hydrogen fuel cell powered airplanes. I saw a hydrogen fuel cell powered car last night, by the way, on the highway. It was kind of wild.
Really?
Toyota Mirai.
What? Driving?
Yeah. Toyota Mirai.
I thought those all went away.
Nope. Saw it. It was kind of wild. Had a whole conversation with my 15-year-old, and he could not have cared less. But anyway. whatever. He was on his
phone. Believe they call that a monologue, not a conversation.
Yes, that is correct. Anyway, Tom Allman, and I appreciate the irony in what I'm about to say. Tom Allman posted in our Facebook group about it, sent a great picture of what a hydrogen fuel tank looks like. You can check it out at the Make Me Smart podcast group on Facebook if you're still on Facebook.
Fascinating. Yeah. Oh, man, I just miss. I know I've said this on the show before, but I miss it when Facebook was fun.
As opposed to.
Because it used to be fun. And like sometimes I'll peek in there just, you know.
Now it's just like
whatever.
Man.
And
it's a little Facebook shaming. That's what we're doing right now.
We're Facebook shaming. Yeah. And it is a shame because Facebook used to be super fun.
Can we buy Facebook offsets?
Hey. It's called TikTok.
Business opportunity. Oh, snap.
And it turns out, it's complicated.
Yeah.
Okay, one last listener comment for you from Namwan from New York.
Hi, Kai. Hi, Molly. I'm Namwan from New York, and your segment on fast fashion raised a thought on sustainability that I've had for some time now, and I'd love to hear your opinion on. It feels like because it's so difficult to make sustainable changes through regulation, so much of this burden of reducing these vast quantities of waste kind of fall on the shoulders of consumers alone. And it just reminds me a lot of what kind of seems to be happening in the economy as a whole, where it's entirely the consumer's burden to sort of keep everything going. And I was just wondering if these two things are related in any sort of direct way, and if so, how?
I think the fact that consumers feel this responsibility and guilt lets a lot of companies and corporations off the hook. So apparently, and there's this sort of amazing story that our wonderful producers put in our rundown about how basically a corporate political action group, an organization pretending to be a pro-environmental group, created the idea of litter bugs and made this ad with a crying Native American, ironically, called, often referred to as the famous crying Indian ad. And it was all aimed at getting people to stop polluting when, in fact, the sort of creators of like disposable, you know, single-use plastics and disposable cups and all of these things just kept doing what they were doing. I don't think it's our responsibility, but I think consumer pressure works.
Yep.
And so it's sort of this like double whammy, right? Like there's only so much that individuals are going to be able to do at this point. But I think you've certainly seen the results when it comes to packaging and new product creation of consumer pressure and of consumers saying we don't want to do this anymore. It's certainly not enough, but it's a start.
All right, to the Make Me Smart question we go. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? Here you go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name is Haiying, and I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I love your shows, and I have learned so much. One thing that I thought I knew and later found out I was wrong about, when I studied at the business school, and later joined the tech industry. I heard the phrase, change the world a lot. The slogan was so simple, powerful, and aspirational that I totally bought it. Yes, change the world. It is always good, right? Then came 2016 and all the fallouts in politics and tech industry. The disruption of global peace and economy. The setback of equal rights and women's rights. The weaponization of social media and targeted marketing. The loss of jobs and communities to automation. Not everyone changed the world to make it a better place. Some people change the world by damaging it. Nor realize the phrase change the world was a bit naive and arrogant and even could be harmful. So instead of changing the world, now I ask myself, how can I benefit the world? Thanks for the great shows. I look forward to every episode.
Oh my God, that is amazing.
Yeah. There's a caveat, right? There's a caveat that has to come with this, and that is, you know, making the world a better place is very much in the eye of the beholder.
That's
not,
true.
Not to be a downer.
Way to buzzkill it. I'm sitting here like, I teared up because that's so great. Yes, lovely sentiment,
but
I'm just saying. You have to admit that as a way to look at it, that is incredible. To say, like, how can I be a positive force
as opposed to ethos, how can I benefit the world, for sure.
How can I benefit the world as opposed to, like, am I the person who... So I am constantly fascinated by how some people believe that they have the absolute right to, you know, to change the course of history. And other people believe that they are not entitled to get the right order at a restaurant. Like, I ordered steak and you brought me Jell-O, but that's okay. Like, I'll just live with it. And how do we there's got to be some middle ground there, right? Between the impact that people believe that they should or could have. Anyway, I think that's wonderful, and this is why I love this question.
It's always thought-provoking, truly.
What is something that you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Send us your voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Also, sign up for the newsletter, marketplace.org/newsletters, so you don't miss any. Subscribe, because, you know, numbers matter. All kinds of great stuff in there, I got to tell you. Erica Phillips does a great job.
She is doing great.
Cheers.
I told her how I think I got norovirus from my dog, and I think she was going to put it in there. The one medical study that said it was possible.
Okay, then.
This is how the world ends. You get viruses from the dog.
Very good. Zombie apocalypse.
It's here. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Heathcote and Summer Dunsmore, and Erica for putting together the newsletter.
Totally. This week's program was engineered by Jay Siebold. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And that's where we are.
that's where we are. By
right
God.
There. And that's the way it is. And was that like Cronkite or something?
The way it is.
That's the way it is.
I don't think that one was Cronkite.
No? All right, I'm going to have to look it up.
No, I'm going to have to look it up too. Oh, was it Paul Harvey?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Hang on. Are you Googling? All right.
Yeah.
Or you're duck-duck going?
That's the way it is. I'm duck-duck going.
It is. Hang on.
Well, to put it in quotes.
Celine Dion song that comes up as the first YouTube video.
That's just the way it is. The Bruce Hornsby, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of songs.
Remember Bruce Hornsby? Wow.
Yeah. And what was it, Bruce Hornsby song?
That's the way it is, 1970? Oh,
Cronkite.
Oh, that's the way it is. Cronkite's tagline. There you go.
Dang.
Boom.
Never doubt the Riz.
I'm a history major, you know.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.